It's the time of year when people get colds and the flu, and they want the disease to go away, which it usually will do even without treatment. That won't stop many people from seeking treatment. We go to all kinds of healers around the world for all kinds of things, especially when we feel like conventional medicine is not helping. Our guest this hour explores healing, conventional medicine, alternative medicine, and our belief in healing in a book called The Magic Feather Effect, The Science of Alternative Medicine and the Surprising Power of Belief. It's the work of Melanie Warner, who's a freelance writer for a bunch of publications with a primary focus on business. She covered the food industry as a staff reporter for the New York Times, and she's the author of her previous book about processed foods, Pandora's Lunchbox. Melanie Warner, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So did writing the book about the diet and health lead you toward this book?
I suppose in a way it's still a fascination with different aspects of human health. Writing about food is how to keep yourself healthy. And this is looking at what happens when people do get sick or do get chronic illnesses, which, you know, most of us will encounter at some point in our lives.
By page two, I got the feeling this could have been a very big book indeed. I mean, when you start trying to catalog types of alternative medicine, this could have gone to volumes, couldn't it?
It could, sure. And there's probably heftier and more comprehensive books out there. But I didn't want to talk about the entire universe. I focused on popular treatments that have a richness to them and have what doctors might and scientists might somewhat dryly call the therapeutic interaction. So you have a lot of you have things like acupuncture, chiropractic, even Tai Chi and Qigong and energy healing as well.
You say this is not about debunking. I mean, what did you want to do starting out?
I wanted to look at what the real story was. I was intrigued by how polarized the debate around alternative medicine seemed to be. You know, you have people that make pretty big claims about what these therapies are capable of. And they believe very fervently in these practices, and they have specific theories on how they work. And then on the other side, you have the skeptics that really make the case that there's not much there, and people are being misled, duped, and probably even wasting their time. And I suspected, like is the case with a lot of contentious debates, that there's some really interesting truth in the middle there. So I wanted to see, can these therapies really help people? Is that why people are still going to them? Is that why people insist that they love going to their acupuncturist or chiropractor? Is there some real value there? And if so, what and how is it working? And so I wanted to look to the science to see what the real evidence was.
There's a real undergirding for the book from the placebo effect, and I'm struck by the quote about medicine being all about placebo effect until recently. That was an interesting perception of where we've come in medical science.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, medical science is so relatively new in terms of the span of human history. You can date it to the 19th century at the earliest, but really it started more like in the middle of the 20th century when we started doing these controlled clinical trials to say, okay, does this therapy work and how does it compare to this therapy? And we started blinding patients so they wouldn't know what they were getting and blinding the people who were giving them the treatments. And that created the rigor that we now know as modern medicine, you know, that's been extremely helpful to people and has prolonged our lifespan, as we all know. And so that's only been a recent thing. So you look at the span of human history, and, you know, we can't look back in time to say exactly what was happening, but the feeling is, a late Harvard professor that used that quote, that people were still able to heal themselves or to help other people heal. They were just doing it through very different means and through what we very broadly call placebo effects.
You start us off with an energy healer, self-proclaimed, Donna Eden. What does she claim to be able to do?
She claims, well, there's a lot of things that she claims. She's a fascinating character. I was very, very drawn to her. She believes that the body, all of our bodies, have what you could call a subtle energy, that there's a force inside our bodies that is always present. It's always moving. When we become stressed or sick, it acts in a certain way. It can get scrambled. And she also claims to be able to see this energy in people. You know, hear different people, they say they can see auras. So that's part of what she says she can see, but she goes beyond that to actually see flows of energy in people in a very complex way. So I spent some time with her and looked at her therapy, and she spent many years actually in Oregon for a while as a practitioner treating people one-on-one, and now she's going around and teaching this brand of what she calls Eden energy healing to other people. And so I wanted to look, you know, I kind of looked a little bit at, is this really possible that there could be energy inside the body? You know, I didn't want to dismiss that completely out of hand. But I really also wanted to look at, could her work as a healer and her methods or methods like her be helping people, but through different mechanisms than what she talks about.
Now, this moment when she pushed on your arm, I mean, it sounds like a simple statement. She pushed my arm. But what happened there?
Yeah, that's something that's called either energy testing, or sometimes people call it muscle testing. Energy healers use it. A lot of chiropractors use it. And they're supposedly testing the energy flow in your body. And so if they'll ask you a question, like, you know, does your knee hurt today? And they press down on your arm, and if it does hurt, or you're answering accurately, you'll be strong. Or if it doesn't hurt, rather, you're answering accurately, you'll be strong. And if not, your body will react and weaken your arm so that they can press your arm down. And maybe people have had this done for testing for food allergies.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's also sometimes used for. And you hold a vial or a certain object in your other hand, and supposedly if you're allergic to it, your body will be weak and your arm will be weak and flop down. And if it's not, your arm will stay strong.
All right, we'll pick up on what this all means when we come back. The Magic Feather Effect is the book. Melanie Warner is the author. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're exploring alternative medicine side by side with conventional medicine with Melanie Warner, who wrote a book called The Magic Feather Effect, The Science of Alternative Medicine and the Surprising Power of Belief. She explored acupuncture, Tai Chi, Qigong, conventional medicine, all sorts of things went on into the book. And you can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about the merits of each, any, none, perhaps. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I wanted to finish up. We were talking about Donna Eden, who talks about the Eden energy healing technique. And so this whole thing where she pushed on your arm went down and at a moment when you didn't expect it to. What was going on?
Exactly. It flopped right down. I felt completely weak and powerless to stop it. And I think other people have had this experience where you go and your arm feels strong 1 minute and then weak the next. So it's a fascinating phenomenon. And there, I looked a little bit to see what was going on with that. And the problem with believing in the idea that it's energy in your body is that when controlled studies are done, when the person giving you the test doesn't know what they're testing, they really don't. There's not an effect where the answer is consistent. It's kind of all over the map, or it's just left to chance. So it doesn't look like these things are really working the way people think they are, and there might be other ways that they're working.
Well, and that's one of the most interesting things about the book is that, I mean, people have investigated the claims of alternative medicines, as we'll detail here, and looked carefully at things like, is there a physical effect? Did the thing that appears to be causing the pain change? And when the answer is no, and the person still feels better, I mean, ultimately, did you end up finding out more about human belief than the practices themselves?
You do. It's a fascinating study in the power of belief. I mean, that's the subtitle of the book. But the way that changing our mindsets and changing what we believe about ourselves and our bodies and our illness, our disease, our ability to heal can have profound shifts in the course of our disease and how we feel in our body day to day with different symptoms like pain or fatigue or anxiety. So belief is it's a soft element of medicine, but placebo researchers are certainly taking it very seriously, and a lot of other people in the medical field are starting to look at it a lot more closely. I spent some time with a dean at Harvard Medical School, excuse me, and he he tries to, he thinks that these soft elements of medicine where you're treating the patient and not just the disease, and you're working with their beliefs and their ideas and their even sometimes their emotions and memories, that's even sometimes more important than all the biomedical stuff that doctors do.
Well, and in fact,
I was surprised to hear him say,
And in fact, there is some crossover too in practice. I mean, you found some conventional clinics with acupuncturists, for example.
Sure, there's a lot of the major university hospitals and facilities around the country now actually have these integrative health centers or wellness centers, or they have different names for them, and they offer services like acupuncture and yoga classes, mindfulness meditation. I spent some time at the Cleveland Clinics Institute for this, and they even have Reiki treatments, which is a type of energy healing where a person barely touches your body. So it's pretty alternative. And they're offering it in part because people want it. There's a demand for it. People are looking for other options. They're saying, well, the things that I'm doing with my doctor, my medications, maybe even physical therapy, aren't helping me, or they're not helping me enough. I want to seek out something else. And then they're doing it in part because some of these therapies are actually starting to have some pretty interesting and good evidence that they can be effective for certain conditions.
Let's get some timelines here. How far back does Chinese medicine go, and where in relation, for example, to the Western medicine traditions that start with Hippocrates in ancient Greece?
The best estimates are that it goes about at least 2,500 years ago. So it's pretty old, which is almost as old as Greek medicine with Hippocrates, which is, of course, the foundation of our system of Western medicine. So it's an old practice, and both systems were extremely sophisticated and rational at the time. Prior to this, throughout most of human history, it's thought that people believed they looked at human health through the prism of the supernatural, and if you got sick or you got better, it had something to do with a spirit or a demon. And both the Chinese people, they were probably elites. The Chinese elites that devised the system that's now the basis of traditional Chinese medicine, including acupuncture, they wanted to look at the natural causes inside the body, within nature, and the natural laws that would govern human health. And the same with the Greeks, who devised a system of the four humors. Now, both of these systems the Greek system is no longer being used, right? We don't believe that there are there's yellow bile in the body. That's a very important fluid. And the same I would argue with acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicine. It was incredibly sophisticated at the time, but it was a time when, way before science, it was a pre-scientific era where people were just trying to figure out basic things like, why do we need to breathe air? Why is that so life-giving?
Right. Yeah, the comparisons are interesting, too. We're talking to Melanie Warner about her book, The Magic Feather Effect, about medicine. And so the Greeks and the humors and the idea that, boy, that lasted until the 19th century, as you point out, that we were still bleeding people because we thought they had too much blood. I'd never heard the figure of just how much blood was pulled out of George Washington before. 8 cups, by my count.
It's fascinating that it lasted that long and throughout history. Yes, exactly.
It is that it lasted that long. But then there are still people who are talking about the Chinese alternative, which is the idea of qi, the energy in the body. How is that adjusted, do they think?
They believe that qi is the life force. It's similar to what Donna Eden talks about. They use different names for it. That there's an energy force in the body that is not... it's not been understood by science. We haven't figured out how to measure it, but it's there. A lot of acupuncturists insist that it still exists. And I think I ended up with a skeptical conclusion about that. I don't think that the idea that scientists would have just entirely missed this and not been able to, with our current technology, not been able to measure this or track this. So I do think it's, and I talked to acupuncturists who are science-based and more rational about the way they look at acupuncture, and they think of them as philosophical constructs and metaphors. It has a usefulness talking about chi and meridians, but it's not necessarily something that literally exists in the body.
So you do get a little further into acupuncture here and bring up the research of Daniel Churkin in Washington State and his big study on acupuncture. It's really fascinating. What did he want to do and what did he find?
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that there have been so many clinical studies on acupuncture, over 1,000 over the last couple decades. A lot of the early ones were very small and not very rigorously controlled. So he was looking at, there was a law passed in Washington State in the early 2000s, where insurance companies, he was working for an insurance company at the time, had to cover acupuncture and chiropractic. And so they wanted to understand, well, okay, we're covering these, so we have to cover these things. You know, we need to have evidence for it. Do they really work? So he started with acupuncture, and he wanted to do a very large, well-controlled clinical trial. And so he got about 600 patients, and he gave them real acupuncture and a fake form of acupuncture. And there are different ways you can do this. He happened to use toothpicks, which is very interesting. And he did it in such a way, he tested the method to make sure that patients couldn't tell the difference. They were blindfolded, and I think most of them had not had acupuncture before. So they were unable to tell which were the toothpicks and which were the real needles. And so the toothpicks wouldn't go into the skin, obviously, where the real thin needles would. And the results were fascinating. It was people with low back pain, chronic low back pain, and the effects that acupuncture had were very similar for the real acupuncture and the fake acupuncture. There wasn't a difference in how people felt in what scientists call the effect sizes when people got the real thing. But interestingly, both of the groups that got the real and the fake acupuncture improved more in terms of their pain and their comfort level over people that were just getting the usual care treatment from their doctors, the medication and exercise and physical therapy. So that kind of suggests that acupuncture can be effective, but it's working through a different mechanism than what people are told, which is the insertion of needles at very specific points throughout the body.
Wow. So, but even toothpicks, you're saying, then had some positive effect.
Exactly. It was the sensation. It's researchers that I talked to that are trying to understand acupuncture. They believe that it has something to do with the bodily sensations that you're getting from an acupuncture treatment. And so if you're getting a poke from a toothpick that feels like the same thing or a very similar sensation to what you're getting from a real needle, then it doesn't really matter. And the thinking is that there's might be a little bit some specificity in terms of where you put these needles or toothpicks on the body, but not a whole lot, not as much as acupuncturists think, that it's really about creating almost like a bodily cue that's part of the ritual, and that cues that something is happening. Maybe even healing is on the way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the body gets a message for sure. The book is called The Magic Feather Effect, The Science of Alternative Medicine and the Surprising Power of Belief. It's the work of Melanie Warner. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange and throw your two cents in at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Melanie.
Howdy.
Hello?
Well, Melanie, here's a couple of things I think I understand or believe. Superstitions, you can believe those without any understanding. And placebos, nowadays especially, you believe it when it's been explained to you in a way that you can understand. And this has to do with the collective unconscious, something that Carl Jung brought up. It's something that we all share together all over the world as human beings. And finally, Jeffrey, I'd just like to ask her, she's been talking about yoga and acupuncture and acupressure and all that sort of thing. What does she think about cupping? Cupping as a therapy, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, yeah, I've ran across some pictures of that when I was collecting pictures for the web version of this. Melanie?
Yeah, I think we all learned about cupping during the most recent Olympics, right, from all the swimmers.
Right.
Cupping has not been subjected to much research and clinical studies, so we don't know a lot about its effectiveness. But my sense is that it would be working in a similar manner to acupuncture. You're essentially creating bodily sensations of these cups and heat going on your body, and then that's a kind of a healing trigger, a healing cue, where the body is sending messages to the brain that can create interesting shifts in how the brain creates certain symptoms, like pain or fatigue or insomnia. So it would be interesting for there to be more research done to show how effective this could be as what we call very broadly a placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
But my sense it might be similar to acupuncture.
Is there any way that you discovered through the process of researching this book to measure a person's susceptibility to placebo effect?
Yeah, the interesting thing is researchers believe they've been trying to for years trying to identify, well, some people are more susceptible to placebos than others. They know that. And they're trying to identify, well, what is that? What is there a personality? Is there a genetic predisposition? Can we isolate the genes? And there's been some work done along that. They think maybe it has to do with genes that regulate dopamine production in your brain. But it's not real clear-cut, and it's very, very early science to make any conclusions about that. Generally, if you ask placebo researchers, they'll say people that are more open to new experiences, open-minded, are more likely to be higher placebo, more likely to have higher placebo responses than people that are very skeptical and view things with caution. But at the end of the day, we know from work that's been done in placebo labs using volunteers with experimental types of pain like heat on your arm that very, very high percentages of people, anywhere from like 60 to 80% of people, are susceptible to a placebo response. And I went and did that myself in a lab in Maryland with a placebo researcher. And I was amazed because even though I knew what I was going in for, I was in a placebo lab, I still had a placebo response. Even though my rational thought was one thing, my body and my brain responded in a completely different, automatic, involuntary way.
Is this Luana Coloco's pain chair?
Exactly.
I was just about to ask about that. So clearly you did more than just ask questions. Tell us about your time in the pain chair.
Yeah, she was sending heat to a box that was attached to my arm, and she ended up doing a form of verbal suggestion, saying, and there was a computer screen, and she said, when it's going to be low heat, it'll be a green screen, and when it's high heat, it'll be red. And the high heat was pretty high. I mean, it sort of felt like someone put a hot pan on my arm for just a few seconds. It only lasted for a few seconds, thankfully. And so she did a couple rounds where that was what was happening. The green was low and the red was high. And then, this is all she told me later, on the third round she switched it and everything was high heat. But I only felt that heat as pain. It only hurt, and I rated it like an 8 or 9 out of a scale of 10. I only felt it when the screen was red. Like my brain had learned to associate and expected there to be that sensation when it was red. And I was amazed by that, just the idea that what had previously felt extremely hot and scalding now felt like just kind of a warm sensation, like someone put, you know, a warm washcloth on my hand or in my arm.
Wow. And so as you go further into the section of the book, my jaw really dropped reading about Henry Beecher's observations of soldiers who came in with battle wounds in World War II.
Yeah, that was one of the first, that was the start of the first systematic study of the placebo effect in the 50s. It was an anesthesiologist who was at Harvard, and he was stationed in Italy during the war on the battlefield. And he started to notice that a lot of these soldiers would come into these makeshift battlefield hospitals, and they'd have horrible wounds from battle, and a large percentage of them would say, "No, no, my pain is okay. I don't need morphine. I'm fine." When people would ask, and he was struck by that. He thought, "How could they not be feeling their pain? You know, they've got this open gash on their, or their leg, or their arm, or their head." And he compared that, and he thought that, and he actually did a systematic study years later when he went back to Boston. And he compared it to civilians in hospitals around Boston after they came in with trauma, usually from a car accident. And he looked at how many of them wanted painkillers. And the numbers, I'm just forgetting the numbers, but it was, you know, it was like 27% of the soldiers versus 80% of the civilians. And so it was a really interesting, eye-opening experience for him where he realized, you know what, pain is not always what we think it is. Mm-hmm. The nature of pain is different. It's not just about what happens to the body and the signals coming up from the body. It's about what happens in the brain and how we interpret those signals.
Okay, short break here, and we'll come back and talk more. The Magic Feather Effect by Melanie Warner, the topic for discussion, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're exploring conventional and alternative medicine side by side with the aid of Melanie Warner, who went out and looked at a lot of treatments and a lot of research and wrote a book called The Magic Feather Effect, The Science of Alternative Medicine and the Surprising Power of Belief. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about acupuncture, Tai Chi, Reiki, Qigong, and of course all kinds of conventional medicine and studies of all the processes we've been talking about as well. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the more we talk about pain, as you researched it in the book, it not all pain is equal, and it seems like not all things that will reduce pain, therefore, are equal in effectiveness.
Yeah, exactly. We were talking about the Harvard anesthesiologist in the 50s, Henry Beecher, that was looking at wounded soldiers, and so his theory was that the soldiers and civilians had very different beliefs and experiences coming to a hospital. The soldiers viewed it as a place of safety. They were now off the battlefield. They were probably going to go home. They were being attended to by nurses and doctors. They were safe. They had very different beliefs versus the civilians. They're just at the start of a long journey after being in an accident or some other kind of trauma. And so he realized that those beliefs that we have and the stories that we have in our head can change the way we feel symptoms like pain in a really, really profound way. And that's we now know later from later research that's a neurobiological effect that happens in our brains. It's not just people pretending or some sort of ephemeral thing. It's actual neurotransmitters that are released inside our brains.
So, not surprisingly, back pain is a regular character in the book, and we meet some people who had different ways of dealing with it. Adam Engel in Colorado chose to do what instead of getting a spinal fusion?
He did a number of different treatments. He went to what you could call a manual therapist. This person kind of calls himself a healer or a shaman. He does, but he mostly works with manual therapy like Rolfing. And so he worked with him, and he worked with another individual that gave him a lot of exercises and worked with him on a sort of specialized table that he had devised. And he developed a very personal, trusting relationship with both these two people over a span of about 5 months. And he'd been dealing with really intense back pain for over 3 years. And I recount the story in the book of how he managed to overcome. He changed his mindset. He changed how he thought about his body and his capacity for healing. And after 5 months, he was pretty much, you know, 80% pain-free, and then down the road, 100% pain-free. And last time I talked to him, he was still feeling great, traveling the world and going on hikes.
Wow. And Peter Churchill, who worked on Adam, didn't go to college. I mean, he's I noticed he's a licensed massage therapist, but that's his major qualification.
Exactly. Yeah, he was self-taught, someone who felt that from a young age, he didn't get into this work until he was in his early 30s, but just felt that he had a natural ability to help people through using his hands. That's how he describes it. And I do believe, I don't think scientists really understand this, but I do believe that some people have more of a capacity to help other people heal than others. They have sort of a gift or an intuition as a healer, and I think he's one of those people. I think he's able to read people, and he's able to kind of read their body and know what their body needs and how to touch them, and he also knows very much how to interact with people and read their emotions. And I think that's a big part of, and this, by the way, it doesn't have to be unique to alternative healers and alternative therapies. There are doctors that can do this. I think we don't see them as in the majority of doctors in our current system, where everything is short appointment times and very transactional. But certainly there are doctors out there, and there have been doctors throughout in the past decades and throughout history that have been able to work as healers as well.
I wonder, though, if there were things that made you when you looked at some of the things that people said, no, this really helped my back pain. If you inside your head was this voice going, come on.
You mean that other people have mentioned stories to me that I didn't believe?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. When I started writing this book, there were a lot of people that would tell me. I just would happen to mention what I was doing. Oh, you know, I had an experience, or my friend, or my relative, or my coworker had this experience. They went to such and such type person, and now they're all better. And I believe a lot of those stories, but some of them you have to take with a grain of salt. Not that people are making anything up, but I think we tend to forget that. Health conditions and diseases do ebb and flow, and sometimes they get better, and sometimes they're worse, and sometimes they clear up on their own for reasons that we completely don't understand. And so people don't always think about the thing that they did the day before, the week before. Mm-hmm. They attribute it to that and don't really think that maybe it kind of went away on its own. So that's why it can be. I really worked hard to find the stories in the book that I wanted to tell, because with anecdotes, it's not science, and you don't always know what the real story is and what really happened inside someone's body.
I know you went in with a very open mind from your own account here, but was there anything that you just thought was too ridiculous to include in the book? I mean, are there things that were left out?
I did, yeah. There are lots of different methods that people use. I think my favorite, I really wanted to write about it, but I just didn't find a way, is a man in Croatia who does... What we can really call, he doesn't like to call it this, but staring. He stares at people for brief spans of time. It's usually about 5 to 7 minutes, usually in groups. His name is Barazzo. He's come to the U.S., but he mostly works in Europe these days. And he stands up on a little dais in front of the crowd. It's very silent. He has an amazing ability not to blink. And he just has this gaze where he looks out at people. And the people that go to him, he has these very devoted people, they feel powerfully moved in different ways by this experience. So I went to a gazing that he did, and I didn't feel any great surge of anything, but it was a completely fascinating experience to see these people so intense and to have such belief in someone's stare.
Well, and not just belief in stairs, but belief in the power of another person to help them in their healing process. And of course, you went to the most obvious place in the world probably for this sort of thing. You went to Lourdes in France, where Saint Bernadette says she saw the Virgin Mary. What was that like? What was that experience like for you?
Yeah, that's also a very powerful place, in that you're surrounded by people that feel that this place is so sacred and so special and so important, and so many people have come through over the years and had, for a lot of people, transformative experiences, whether emotionally or physically. So, yeah, I went there to experience it, but also to investigate one of their most recent miracles, where a woman was claimed to be healed of a condition that she had instantaneously, and I spent some time with her talking about what happened and trying to understand what really might have happened that day, and in the late 80s to this woman who was Italian.
That's Danila Castelli. Her case is a rather perplexing one, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. It she was supposedly she had a metabolic disorder, and she suffered from blood pressure surges for about a decade, and this caused heart palpitations and sweating and headaches, and it was kind of like a feeling, a little bit like a panic attack, but you know, a feeling that you know, you might die because it's so intense in your body. And as it was interesting, as I talked to people in the medical field that study these conditions, they told me very few people actually have this. It's a very rare disorder. About, you know, only a few percent of people that initially doctors think have it don't. And there are other conditions that are a little bit more what you might call brain-based. So panic attack, it is very similar to panic attacks. And there's another condition that doctors believe that mimics this as well. And it got me into a whole world of what you might call psychosomatic illnesses, which has such a very negative connotation in our culture. It suggests that people are making something up or being hypochondriacs.
The old it's all in your head thing, yeah.
It's all in your head, yeah. The more I got into it, I realized that's not the story at all. These are real things that people experience, but they experience them for different reasons. Then it's not just a bodily issue. It's something to do with the brain and the way your brain is wired.
We have an email here from Tom in Medford who writes, as a registered nurse, I've heard a lot of people use medical marijuana for pain. I'm quite skeptical of that, but I realize, as your author notes, each person deals with pain in their own way. I ran into a church pastor who had to retire because of chronic back pain. He was happy and painting his house and invited me in to partake of his medical marijuana. I was shocked, and his response intrigued me. He said the typical painkillers were only messing up his life and not making his pain any better. He said medical marijuana also did not take away his pain, but changed the way he related to it. That was the most profound insight I have heard into pain treatment. Appreciatively, Tom in Medford. Interesting story there, but similar to the stuff you found.
Yeah, I think that's a really intelligent insight and wise insight. It is about how we relate to our, especially our pain, and the way we interpret it. It can dramatically change our experience of it, and actually how much pain we feel. So that's what I explored a lot in the book, and I talked to a lot of people who had shifted through one means or another. There are many ways to do it, and I do think it's a little bit specific to the individual and what the individual, an individual person is able to relate to and connect to. But that's a big part of the story of pain and chronic pain.
You know, I focused on pain so heavily in this discussion, but the book does deal with other things. And I want to touch on the immune system and disease and about how stress affects the system. I mean, is there measurable deficiencies to the immune system when we have stress in our bodies?
Yeah, there's been a lot of interesting research in the last decade or so on the effect of stress on the immune system. We know that when we're stressed or anxious and under sort of a low-grade level of what you could call panic almost, that creates inflammation in our bodies. It's like a mini fight-or-flight response, which is a fantastic response that our bodies have when we're being chased by a wild animal or about to be hit by a bus. Our bodies go into immediate reaction mode so we can get away from the danger. But when we're experiencing that same kind of stress, although at a lower level, consistently, it creates all kinds of problems in our body, and the biggest one is inflammation. We're susceptible to having these molecules in our body that turn on inflammation, and it can be very hard to turn it off. So using interventions that reduce stress, and I spent some time at UCLA where they've been looking at yoga, mindfulness meditation. They have a mindfulness meditation center there where they teach classes and people how to do this. How to use mindfulness meditation to have a different approach to life and to calm yourself down. And then they've also looked at Tai Chi as well, and they've all of these things reduce the stress level in your body, and they can reduce the level of inflammation that you have as well, which is a fascinating connection.
Ultimately, Melanie, did you come to some sort of conclusion? Like, did you get a sense that conventional and alternative medicine have some things to learn from each other?
Yeah, absolutely. I think alternative medicine could benefit by being a little bit more science-based and being more open to the ways in which their therapies might be working through known physiology, like some of the things that, we've been talking about, like placebo effects and stress reduction. And then on the other side, conventional medicine, I think, does have things to learn from alternative medicine. The interaction and the ability to create empathetic connections with patients, with people, the way that that can have a powerful effect on the outcomes and on the way people feel and on the course of disease as well. I think a lot of that, doctors at some medical schools are taught this, and they know that this is very important, but it tends to get a little bit lost as they go through their practice.
Well, it's clear that there's a lot more going on here than flipping switches and tightening the bolts. I mean, maintenance of the human body is a bit more touchy than that. The book is called The Magic Feather Effect, The Science of Alternative Medicine and the Surprising Power of Belief. It's the work of Melanie Warner, who also wrote Pandora's Lunchbox. Melanie, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.